You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Risky Business by Katherine Aben. Chasing scientific renown, grant dollars, and approval from Dr. Anthony Fauci, Peter Daszak transformed an environmental nonprofit into a U.S.-funded sponsor of controversial virus research in China. An in-depth investigation shows how an organization dedicated to stopping the next pandemic found itself suspected of helping start one. Opening illustration by Michelle Thompson. Echo Health Alliance President Peter Daszak funneled U.S. grant dollars allocated by Dr. Anthony Fauci to virologist Ralph Barrick in North Carolina and Xi Jingli in Wuhan. On June 18, 2021, an evolutionary biologist named Jesse D. Bloom sent the draft of an unpublished scientific paper he'd written to Dr. Anthony Fauci, the chief medical advisor to the President of the United States. The paper he had written, known as a preprint because it had yet to be peer-reviewed or published, contained sensitive revelations about the National Institutes of Health, the federal agency that oversees biomedical research. In the interest of transparency, he wanted Fauci, who helms an NIH sub-agency, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, to see it ahead of time. Under ordinary circumstances, the preprint might have sparked a respectful exchange of views. But this was no ordinary preprint and no ordinary moment. More than a year into the pandemic, the genesis of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, was still a mystery. Most scientists believed that it had made the leap from bats to humans naturally via an intermediary species, most likely at a market in Wuhan, China, where live wild animals were slaughtered and sold. But a growing contingent were asking if it could have originated inside a nearby laboratory that is known to have conducted risky coronavirus research, funded in part by the United States. As speculation swirled, the NIH was being bombarded by Freedom of Information Act, FOIA lawsuits. Fauci himself needed a security detail owing to death threats from conspiracy theorists. Bloom had discovered that a number of early SARS-CoV-2 genomic sequences mentioned in a published paper from China had vanished without a trace. The sequences, which map a virus's unique genetic identity, are key to tracking a pandemic's early spread. Bloom wondered if their disappearance meant that the Chinese government was trying to hide evidence. Piecing together clues, Bloom established that the NIH itself had deleted the sequences from its own archive at the request of researchers in Wuhan. Now, he was hoping Fauci and his boss, NIH Director Francis Collins, could identify other deleted sequences that might shed light on the mystery. Bloom had submitted the paper to a preprint server, a repository of scientific papers awaiting peer review, on the same day he'd sent a copy to Fauci and Collins. Collins organized a Zoom meeting for Sunday, June 20th. He invited two outside scientists, evolutionary biologist Christian Anderson and virologist Robert Gary, and allowed Bloom to do the same. Bloom recommended Sergei Pond, an evolutionary biologist, and Rasmus Nielsen, a genetic biologist, that it was shaping up like an old-fashioned duel with seconds in attendance did not cross Bloom's mind. But 6 months later, he remained so disturbed by the meeting that he wrote a detailed account which Vanity Fair obtained. After Bloom described his research, the Zoom meeting became extremely contentious, he wrote. Anderson said he found the preprint deeply troubling. If the Chinese scientists wanted to delete their sequences from the database, which NIH policy entitled them to do, it was unethical for Bloom to analyze them further, he claimed. And there was nothing unusual about the early genomic sequences in Wuhan. Instantly, Nielsen and Anderson were yelling at each other, Bloom recounted, with Nielsen insisting that the sequences were extremely puzzling. Bloom wrote that Anderson, who'd had some of his emails with Fauci from early in the pandemic publicly released through FOIA request, leveled a third objection, that Bloom's preprint would fuel conspiratorial notions that China was hiding data, and thereby lead to more criticism of scientists such as himself. Fauci then weighed in, objecting to the preprint's description of Chinese scientists surreptitiously deleting the sequences. The word was loaded, said Fauci, and the reason they'd ask for the deletions was unknown. That's when, according to Bloom, Anderson made a surprising suggestion. He said he was a screener at the preprint server, which gave him access to papers that weren't yet public. He offered to either entirely delete the preprint or revise it in a way that would leave no record that this had been done. Bloom refused. At that point, both Fauci and Collins distanced themselves from Anderson's offer, with Fauci saying, as Bloom recalled, "Just for the record, I want to be clear that I never suggested you delete or revise the preprint." Both Anderson and Gary denied that anyone in the meeting suggested deleting or revising the paper. Anderson said Bloom's account was false. Gary dismissed it as nonsense. Pond, however, confirmed Bloom's account as accurate. A spokesperson for Fauci declined to comment. The wagon circling on that Zoom call reflected a siege mentality at the NIH, whose cause was much larger than Bloom and the missing sequences. It all began with a once obscure science nonprofit in Manhattan that had become the conduit for federal grant money to a Wuhan research laboratory. In 2014, Fauci's agency had issued a $3.7 million grant to Echo Health Alliance, a non-governmental organization dedicated to predicting and helping to prevent the next pandemic by identifying viruses that could leap from wildlife to humans. The grant, titled Understanding the Risk of Bat Coronavirus Emergence, proposed to collect and analyze bat viruses and build predictive models to assess their risk of infecting humans. The Wuhan Institute of Virology, WIV, was a key collaborator to whom Echo Health Alliance gave almost $600,000 in subawards. But the work there had been controversial enough that the NIH suspended the grant in July 2020. As it happened, Echo Health Alliance failed to predict the COVID-19 pandemic, even though it erupted into view at the Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market, a short drive from the WIV itself. In the ensuing months, every move of Echo Health Alliance's voluble president, Peter Daszak, came under scrutiny by a small army of scientific sleuths and assorted journalists. Why had he been so cagey about the work his organization had been funding at the WIV? In 2018, Daszak had appeared on Chinese state-run TV and said, "The work we do with Chinese collaborators is published jointly in international journals, and the sequence data is uploaded onto the internet free for everyone to read." He added, "Science is naturally transparent and open. You do something, you discover something, you want to tell the world about it." But as COVID-19 rampaged across the globe, the Chinese government refused to share raw data from early patient cases or participate in any further international efforts to investigate the virus's origin. And in September 2019, 3 months before the officially recognized start of the pandemic, the WIV took down its database of some 22,000 virus samples and sequences, refusing to restore it despite international request. In the U.S., meanwhile, Daszak early on said about covertly organizing a letter in the Lancet Medical Journal that sought to present the lab leak hypothesis as a groundless conspiracy theory. And Fauci and a small group of scientists, including Anderson and Gary, worked to enshrine the natural origin theory during confidential discussions in early February 2020, even though several of them privately expressed that they felt a lab-related incident was likelier. Just days before those discussions began, Vanity Fair has learned Dr. Robert Redfield, a virologist and the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, had urged Fauci privately to vigorously investigate both the lab and natural hypotheses. He was then excluded from the ensuing discussions, learning only later that they'd even occurred. Their goal was to have a single narrative, Redfield told Vanity Fair. Why top scientists linked arms to tamp down public speculation about a lab leak remains unclear. Was it simply because their views shifted in favor of a natural origin? Could it have been to protect against a revelation that could prove fatal to certain risky research that they deem indispensable? Or to protect vast streams of grant money from political interference or government regulation? The effort to close the debate in favor of the natural origin hypothesis continues today. In February, the New York Times gave front-page treatment to a set of preprints written by Michael Warraby at the University of Arizona and 17 co-authors, including Anderson and Gary, claiming that a new analysis of public data from the Huanan market in Wuhan provided dispositive evidence that the virus first leapt to humans from animals sold there. But a number of top scientists, Bloom among them, questioned that assertion. Some scientists seem almost hell-bent on naming the Huanan market as the site of the origin of the pandemic, and some members of the media seem more than happy to embrace these conclusions without careful examination, said Stanford microbiologist David Relman. Daszak, a Western scientist immersed in Chinese coronavirus research at the WIV, was uniquely positioned to help the world crack open the origin mystery, not least by sharing what he knew. But last year, Jeffrey Sachs, the Columbia University economist who oversees the Lancet's COVID-19 Commission, dismissed Daszak from the helm of a task force investigating the virus's genesis after he flatly refused to share progress reports from his contested research grant. In written responses to detailed questions, Daszak said he was simply following NIH guidance when he declined Sachs' request. He added the reports are now public. DASEC and NIH have acted badly, Sachs told Vanity Fair. There has been a lack of transparency, and there is a lot more to know, and that can be known. He said that the NIH should support an independent scientific investigation to examine the possible role in the pandemic of the NIH, Echo Health Alliance, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and a partner laboratory at the University of North Carolina. We are also on record as welcoming independent scientific investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, DASEC said. This story is based on more than 100,000 internal Echo Health Alliance documents obtained by Vanity Fair, almost all of which predate the pandemic, as well as interviews with 5 former staff members and 33 other sources. While the documents do not tell us where COVID-19 came from, they shed light on the world in which Echo Health Alliance has operated, one of murky grant agreements, flimsy oversight, and the pursuit of government funds for scientific advancement, in part by pitching research of steeply escalating risk. The story of how DASEC's grant entangled Fauci in the specter of Wuhan coronavirus research began years earlier at a stately Beaux-Arts social club in Washington, D.C. For more than a decade, Echo Health Alliance hosted a series of cocktail parties at the Cosmos Club near DuPont Circle to discuss the prevention of viral outbreaks. There, scientists and journalists mingled with the true guest of honor, federal government bureaucrats who were in the position to steer grants. On invitations, Echo Health Alliance described the events as educational. Inside the nonprofit, however, officials called them cultivation events. For about $8,000 in Brie and Chardonnay per event, they got to network with prospective federal funders. As the organization's 2018 strategic plan spelled out, given our strength in federal funding, we enhanced our cultivation events at the Cosmos Club in Washington, D.C., which now regularly attract 75 to 150 people at high levels in government agencies, NGOs, and the private sector. These kinds of events are common among many non-governmental organizations and nonprofits, DASEC told Vanity Fair. Of all those high-level people, almost no one ranked as high as Fauci, a scientific kingmaker who dispensed billions in grant money each year, and DASEC was determined to share a podium with him. On September 9, 2013, DASEC emailed Fauci's senior advisor, David Morins, to see if the sought-after NIAID chief would be available as a panel speaker. Morins emailed back, recommending that DASEC write Tony directly, thanking him for meeting with you all recently, and then inviting him to be a member of this Cosmos Club discussion. That way, it is personal and doesn't look cooked by us. Though Fauci declined that invitation and several others, DASEC kept trying. In February 2016, Morins passed along a valuable tip. Fauci normally says no to almost everything like this. Unless ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox are all there with cameras running, if he were asked to give the main talk or the only talk, that might increase the chances. The gambit worked. Fauci signed on to give a presentation on the Zika virus at the Cosmos Club on March 30th, and the RSVPs flowed in. The guest came from an array of deep-pocketed federal agencies, the Department of Homeland Security, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Pentagon, even NASA. As Daszak would declare at a board meeting on December 15th, the Washington, D.C. cultivation events have been a great way to increase our visibility to federal funders, according to meeting minutes. If a shared podium with Fauci proved that Daszak had become a true player among virus hunters, it has also underscored just how far he had come. For years, Daszak sat at the helm of a struggling nonprofit with a mission to save manatees, promote responsible pet ownership, and celebrate threatened species. Balding and usually clad in hiking gear, Daszak was one part salesman, one part visionary. He saw clearly that human incursions into the natural world could lead to the emergence of animal pathogens, with bats a particularly potent reservoir. The bioterror attacks of 2001, in which letters dusted with anthrax spores were sent through the U.S. mail, coupled with the first SARS coronavirus outbreak in China the following year, would bring money for the study of lethal natural pathogens pouring into federal agencies. In 2003, the NIAID got an eye-popping $1.7 billion for research to defend against bioterrorism. Daszak's office on Manhattan's far west side didn't have a laboratory. The closest bat colonies were in Central Park. But he cultivated an affiliation with Xi Jingli, a Chinese scientist who would rise to become the director of the Wuhan Institute of Virology's Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases. Slight and sophisticated, with an international education, she became known in China as Batwoman for her fearless exploration of their habitats. Daszak's alliance with her would open China's bat caves to him. In 2005, after conducting field research in four locations in China, Daszak and Xi co-authored their first paper together, which established that horseshoe bats were a likely reservoir for SARS-like coronaviruses. They would go on to collaborate on 17 papers, and were the first to report that a SARS-like bat coronavirus might be able to infect human cells without first jumping to an intermediate animal. Peter respected her, said a former Echo Health Alliance staffer. In the view of everyone, they were doing great work for the world. As Daszak's staff and Xi's graduate students intermingled, traveling between Wuhan and Manhattan, the exchange flourished. When Xi visited New York, the Echo Health staff carefully selected a restaurant for a celebratory dinner. Jingli is not one to stand on formality. She makes dumplings by hand with her students in the lab. Daszak's chief of staff wrote to another employee, "She got her PhD in France, loves red wine, and likes good food above formality." By 2009, bats had turned into big money. That September, USAID awarded a $75 million grant called PREDICT to four organizations, including Daszak's. It was the most comprehensive zoonotic virus surveillance project in the world, USAID stated, and its purpose was to identify and predict viral emergence, in part by sampling and testing bats and other wildlife in remote locations. The $18 million over 5 years awarded to what was then Wildlife Trust was a game-changer, Daszak told his staff in an ecstatic email sharing the news. "I want to take this opportunity, despite 7 hours of drinking champagne, literally, to thank all of you for your support." The money transformed the ragged nonprofit. It increased its budget by half, ending a years-long operating loss, and began a long-deferred rebranding, which led to the new name EchoHealth Alliance. Over the course of the grant, The organization allocated $1.1 million to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, USAID recently acknowledged in a letter to Congress. When Dr. Maureen Miller, an infectious disease epidemiologist, arrived at Echo Health Alliance in 2014, she landed in an environment that she found to be toxic and secretive. She soon came to believe that she was hired because they needed a senior-level woman, she said, adding, "I was excluded from pretty much everything." Miller began creating a surveillance strategy to detect zoonotic virus spillover. Chinese villagers living near bat caves would have their blood tested for antibodies to a SARS-like coronavirus. Then answer questionnaires to determine if certain behaviors had led them to be exposed. It was a biological and behavioral warning system, Miller explained. Next illustration, former CDC Director Robert Redfield says Dr. Anthony Fauci and others wanted a single narrative. Former Deputy National Security Advisor Matt Pottinger says Chinese military scientists were active at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Over the next 2 years, Miller worked closely with Xi, who developed the test to screen the villagers' blood. In that time, Miller noted, I never got a result from Xi via phone. I had to show up in China to learn anything from her. From that, Miller gleaned that while Xi was a world-class scientist, she respects the Chinese system. In short, she followed the Chinese government's rules. Xi did not respond to written questions. Miller left Echo Health Alliance in November 2016. A year later, Xi alerted Miller's former assistant to the fact that Daszak was about to get credit for her work in an upcoming publication. Xi went out of her way to ensure I would be included, Miller said. The final version of a letter, published in January 2018 in the Wuhan Institute of Virology's journal, Virologica Sinica, included Miller's name. 6 out of 218 villagers had tested positive for antibodies, suggesting that the strategy was a successful way to gauge potential spillover. The experience left Miller with a dark impression of Daszak. He is so single-minded that he wants to be the one who makes the discovery without having to share. Daszak said Miller has been credited as a co-author on at least 8 papers stemming from her work at Echo Health Alliance, a testimony to the equity, fairness, and openness of our publication and authorship practices. He added that the nonprofit staff is diverse and culturally sensitive. Daszak's $3.7 million NIH grant first set off alarm bells in early May 2016. The NIH requires annual progress reports, but Daszak's year 2 report was late, and the agency threatened to withhold funds until he filed it. The report he finally did submit worried the agency's grant specialist. It stated that scientists plan to create an infectious clone of MERS, a novel coronavirus found in dromedaries that had emerged in Saudi Arabia in 2012 and killed 35% of the humans it infected. The report also made clear that the NIH grant had already been used to construct 2 chimeric coronaviruses similar to the one that caused SARS, which emerged in 2002 and went on to cause at least 774 deaths worldwide. A chimeric virus is one that combines fragments of different viruses. These revelations prompted the NIH's grant specialist to ask whether the work should be subject to a federal moratorium on gain-of-function research. Such research was the subject of a years-long debate that had divided the virology community. In 2011, two scientists separately announced that they had genetically altered H5N1, the bird flu virus that has killed at least 456 people since 2003. The scientists gave the virus new functions, enabling it to spread efficiently among ferrets, which are genetically closer to humans than mice, as a way to gauge its risk to people. Both studies had received NIH funding. Proponents of what became known as gain-of-function research claimed it could help prevent pandemics by highlighting potential threats. Critics argued that creating pathogens that didn't exist in nature ran the risk of unleashing them. Fauci ultimately supported the research, arguing in a co-authored Washington Post op-ed that important information and insights can come from generating a potentially dangerous virus in the laboratory. In October 2014, the Obama administration imposed a moratorium on new federal funding for research that could make influenza, MERS, or SARS viruses more virulent or transmissible. But loopholes allowed DASAC to try to save the research. On June 8, 2016, he wrote to the NIH's grant specialist that his proposed research was exempt from the moratorium. He also pointed to a 2015 research paper in which scientists had infected humanized mice with the same strains and found that they were less lethal than the original SARS virus. But the 2015 study he cited was not particularly reassuring. In it, she and a preeminent coronavirus researcher at the University of North Carolina, Ralph Barrick, mixed components of SARS-like viruses from different species and created a novel chimera that was able to directly infect human cells. Barrick did not respond to written questions seeking comment. This gain-of-function experiment, which began before the moratorium, was so fraught that the authors flagged the dangers themselves, writing, "Scientific review panels may deem similar studies too risky to pursue." The paper's acknowledgments cited funding from the NIH and from EcoHealth Alliance through a different grant. If anything, the MERS study DASAC proposed was even riskier. So he pitched a compromise to the NIH. If any of the recombined strains showed 10 times greater growth than a natural virus, we will immediately, 1, stop all experiments with the mutant, 2, inform our NIAID program officer and the UNC Institutional Biosafety Committee of these results, and 3, participate in decision-making trees to decide appropriate paths forward. A puzzled NIH program officer wrote to DASAC, "Can you clarify where the work with chimeric viruses will actually be performed?" DASAC acknowledged the mistake, responding, "UNC has no oversight of the chimera work, all of which will be conducted at the Wuhan Institute of Virology." By July 7th, the NIH agreed to DASAC's terms, which relied entirely on mutual transparency. She would inform him of any concerning developments involving the lab-constructed viruses, and he would inform the agency. DASAC replied enthusiastically to a program officer, "This is terrific. We are very happy to hear that our gain-of-function research funding pause has been lifted." Allowing such risky research to go forward at the Wuhan Institute of Virology was simply crazy, in my opinion, says Jack Nunberg, director of the Montana Biotechnology Center. Reasons are lack of oversight, lack of regulation in China. So that is what really elevates it to the realm of, no, this shouldn't happen. A subsequent development seemed to support that view. On January 15, 2021, in the waning days of the Trump administration, the State Department released a fact sheet asserting that Chinese military scientists had been collaborating with the WIV's civilian scientists since 2017, if not earlier. That raised the question of whether research there was being repurposed for offensive or military uses. Though Xi and other WIV leaders had previously denied such collaboration occurred, former Deputy National Security Advisor Matthew Pottinger calls those denials willful lies. If China's military had been collaborating with WIV scientists, it's unclear if Daszak would have realized it. The work being done there was always an enigma, a former EcoHealth Alliance staffer told Vanity Fair. He doesn't know what happened in that lab. He cannot know that. According to Daszak, EcoHealth Alliance was aware of the WIV's research activities related to its NIH grant. He says he had no knowledge of Chinese military involvement there and was never notified of any by the U.S. government. By 2017, EcoHealth Alliance faced a brewing financial crisis. 91% of its funding came from the federal government, and 71% of that came from the PREDICT grant, according to minutes of the organization's finance committee meeting. The renewed grant, known as PREDICT II, was slated to end in 2 years. The looming possibility that it would expire without being renewed came to be known internally as the PREDICT cliff. One possible way to ward off a looming $8 million shortfall was to use the Defense Department as a federal life raft in a new ocean of grants. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, was seeking proposals for a new program called PREEMPT, which aimed to identify animal pathogens to preempt their entry into human populations before an outbreak occurs. For EcoHealth Alliance, the PREEMPT grant seemed like a slam dunk. David Morins, senior advisor to Fauci, said that Daszak was one of the key players in understanding that emerging diseases came from animals. And if you knew where the animals were and what diseases they carried, you could predict hotspots. Others, however, questioned the effectiveness of Daszak's approach. In 20 years of using a method of predictive modeling, EcoHealth Alliance did not predict a single outbreak, epidemic, or pandemic, Maureen Miller told Vanity Fair. Last September, EcoHealth Alliance's grant proposal to DARPA was leaked to Drastic, a loosely affiliated global group of sleuths, ranging from professional scientist to amateur data enthusiast, dedicated to investigating the origins of COVID-19. From the 75-page proposal, a striking detail stood out: a plan to examine SARS-like bat coronaviruses for furring cleavage sites and possibly insert new ones that would enable them to infect human cells. A furin cleavage site is a spot in the surface protein of a virus that can boost its entry into human cells. SARS-CoV-2, which emerged more than a year after the DARPA grant was submitted, is notable among SARS-like coronaviruses for having a unique furin cleavage site. Documents obtained by Vanity Fair shed new light on the chaotic process surrounding the DARPA proposal, which was co-created with colleagues, including Xi Jingli at the WIV and Ralph Barrick at the University of North Carolina. Those documents were being written by many, many people, one former EcoHealth Alliance employee recalled. The grant application proposed to collect bat samples from caves in Yunnan province, transport them to Wuhan Institute of Virology, extract and manipulate the viruses they contained, and use them to infect mice with humanized lungs. It would then map high-risk areas for bats harboring dangerous pathogens and treat test caves with substances to reduce the amount of virus they were shedding. It was a long way from saving manatees from motorboats. By almost any definition, this was gain-of-function research. The federal moratorium had been lifted in January 2017 and replaced with a system that required a safety review by the agency funding the research. EcoHealth Alliance's DARPA proposal asserted that its research would be exempt from this review. At a staff meeting on March 29, 2018, Daszak expressed dismay at the slapdash and amateur nature of the DARPA submission. It was a major failure on all accounts, he noted, enumerating a cascade of mistakes, including missed deadlines and errors uploading documents. What was needed, he exhorted his staff, was a change in culture as part of a mentality to get money, according to the meeting minutes. Inside DARPA, the grant application was met with immediate skepticism. The contract was never awarded because of the horrific lack of common sense it reflected, said a former DARPA official who was there at the time. EcoHealth Alliance, he added, was viewed as a ragtag group, willing to get on an Air China jet and stay in bad hotels. Likewise, the WIV was viewed as subpar, especially when compared with the Harbin Veterinary Research Institute, which operated China's only other high-containment laboratory with the highest biosafety protocol, BSL-4. Harbin was China's Harvard, said the former DARPA official. The WIV was more like a safety school. Though two of three DARPA reviewers deemed it selectable, the third, a program manager in the Biological Technologies Office, recommended against funding it. He wrote that the application did not adequately mention or assess the gain-of-function risk or the possibility that the proposed work could constitute dual-use research of concern, the technical term for science that can be repurposed to cause harm or endanger security. The DARPA proposal was basically a roadmap to a SARS-CoV-2-like virus, says virologist Simon Wayne Hobson. If the research had the blessing of a top coronavirus scientist like Barrick, then it is possible the WIV would have wanted to copy what it viewed as cutting-edge science, he said. That doesn't mean they did it, but it means it's legitimate to ask the question. According to Daszak, no one at DARPA expressed any concerns about the proposed research to EcoHealth Alliance. He added, the research was never done by EHA or, to my knowledge, any of the collaborating partners on that proposal. In late December 2019, cases of what would soon be identified as SARS-CoV-2 began emerging around the Hunan seafood wholesale market in the Jingyang district of Wuhan, roughly 8 miles from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Daszak seemed poised to play a leading role in the emerging crisis. On January 30, 2020, he went on to CGTN America, the U.S. outpost for Chinese state television, and said, "We are seeing a small amount of human-to-human transmission in other countries, but it's not uncontrollable." He added that the Chinese government was taking all necessary steps to be open and transparent. In fact, the opposite was true. The virus was spreading uncontrollably, and the Chinese government was busy crushing anyone who spoke out. It ordered laboratory samples destroyed, punished doctors who raised alarms, and claimed the right to review any scientific research about COVID-19 ahead of publication, a restriction that remains in place today. At the highest levels of the U.S. government, alarm was growing over the question of where the virus had originated and whether research performed at the WIV and funded in part by U.S. taxpayers had played some role in its emergence. To Robert Redfield, CDC director at the time, it seemed not only possible, but likely that the virus had originated in a lab. I personally felt it wasn't biologically plausible that SARS-CoV-2 went from bats to humans through an intermediate animal and became one of the most infectious viruses to humans, he told Vanity Fair. Neither the 2002 SARS virus nor the 2012 MERS virus had transmitted so efficiently from one person to another. What had changed? The difference, Redfield believed, was the gain-of-function research that she and Barrick had published in 2015 and that Echo Health Alliance had helped to fund. They had established that it was possible to alter a SARS-like bat coronavirus so that it would infect human cells via a protein called the ACE2 receptor. Although their experiments had taken place in Barrick's well-secured laboratory in Chapel Hill, who was to say that the WIV had not continued the research on its own? In mid-January 2020, Redfield expressed his concerns in separate phone conversations with three scientific leaders, Fauci, Jeremy Farrar, the director of the UK's Wellcome Trust, and Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization. Redfield's message, he says, was simple. We had to take the lab leak hypothesis with extreme seriousness. It is not clear whether Redfield's concerns are what sparked Fauci's own. But on Saturday night, February 1st, at 12:30 a.m., Fauci emailed the NIAID's Principal Deputy Director, Hugh Auchincloss, under the subject line, Important. He attached the 2015 paper by Barrick and Shi and wrote, Hugh, it is essential that we speak this morning. Keep your cell phone on. He instructed Auchincloss to read the attached paper and added, You will have task today that must be done. February 1st proved to be a critical day. With the death count in China passing 300 and cases popping up in more than a dozen countries, Farrar convened a group of 11 top scientists across five time zones. That morning, he asked Fauci to join. My preference is to keep this group really tight, Farrar wrote. Obviously, ask everyone to treat in total confidence. Fauci, Francis Collins, Christian Anderson, and Robert Gary all joined the call. No one invited Redfield or even told him it was happening. In the conference call and emails that followed over the next 4 days, the scientist parsed the peculiarities of SARS-CoV-2's genomic sequence, paying special attention to the furin cleavage site. Dr. Michael Farzan, an immunologist, leaned toward the lab origin hypothesis, telling a member of the group, I think it becomes a question of whether you believe in this series of coincidences, what you know of the lab in Wuhan, how much could be in nature, accidental release, or natural event. I am 70-30 or 60-40. He was not alone. Gary remarked on the stunning composition of the furin cleavage site, I just can't figure out how this gets accomplished in nature. The previous evening, Anderson had emailed Fauci saying that he and scientists, including Gary, Farzan, and the Australian virologist Edward Holmes, all found the genetic sequence inconsistent with expectations from evolutionary theory. But within 3 days, four of the scientists on the call, including Anderson, Gary, and Holmes, had shared the draft of a letter arguing the opposite. Farrar shared a copy with Fauci, who offered feedback ahead of its publication on March 17th in Nature Medicine. The letter, The Proximal Origin of SARS-CoV-2, analyzed the genomic sequence and made a seemingly unequivocal statement. We do not believe that any type of laboratory-based scenario is plausible. How they arrived at such certainty within 4 days remains unclear. On February 11th, one of its five authors, the Columbia University epidemiologist W. Ian Lipkin, emailed a co-author saying that a draft of the letter does not eliminate the possibility of inadvertent release through routine laboratory work cultivating a virus at the WIV. He added, given the scale of the BAT-CoV research pursued there, and the site of emergence of the first human cases, we have a nightmare of circumstantial evidence to assess. A Wellcome spokesman told Vanity Fair, Dr. Farrar's view is that there was at no stage any political influence or interference. Gary said that it was frankly tiresome to explain for the umpteenth time that was one email, cherry-picked among dozens, even hundreds, in part of an ongoing scientific discussion. While Anderson and the others were fine-tuning the proximal origin letter, Daszak was quietly working to bury speculation of a lab leak. On February 19th, in a letter published in The Lancet, he joined 26 scientists in asserting, "We stand together to strongly condemn conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin." 9 months later, emails released by a Freedom of Information group showed that Daszak had orchestrated the Lancet statement with the intention of concealing his role and creating the impression of scientific unanimity. Under the subject line, "No need for you to sign the statement, Ralph," he wrote to Barrick and another scientist, "You, me, and him should not sign this statement, so it has some distance from us, and therefore doesn't work in a counterproductive way." Among the signatories of the Lancet statement was Jeremy Farrar. Reading the Lancet letter, with Farrar's name attached to it, Redfield had a dawning realization. They made a decision, almost a PR decision, that they were going to push one point of view only, and suppress vigorous debate, said Redfield. They argued they did it in defense of science, but it was antithetical to science. A Wellcome spokesperson told Vanity Fair, Dr. Farrar does not believe the Lancet letter was covertly organized. He had no conflict of interest to declare. During a White House COVID-19 press briefing on April 17, 2020, a reporter for the right-wing television network Newsmax asked President Donald Trump why the NIH would fund a $3.7 million grant to a high-level lab in China. The details were wrong, and the question seemed queued up to feed an anti-China political agenda. Trump responded, "We will end that grant very quickly." 7 days later, Daszak received a sharply worded letter from a senior NIH official. His bat coronavirus research grant, which had provided subgrants to the WIV, was being terminated. So began a bitter ongoing battle between Daszak and the NIH over whether he'd complied with the grant's terms. Daszak also faced increasingly pointed questions about the WIV's decision to take down its online database of 22,000 genomic sequences in September 2019, prior to the known onset of the pandemic. Why would a database supported by U.S. tax dollars to help prevent and respond to a pandemic be made inaccessible exactly when it was needed to fulfill its intended purpose? Ask Jamie Metzl, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, who was among the first to call for a full investigation of COVID-19's origins. By October 2021, the NIH had repeatedly demanded that Echo Health Alliance turn over data related to its grant research with the WIV. Daszak argued that he couldn't share a number of SARS coronavirus sequences because he was waiting for the Chinese government to authorize their release. The explanation seemed to undercut the entire rationale for having the U.S. government help fund a global collaboration on virus emergence. Reached for comment, Daszak said it was incorrect to suggest that Echo Health Alliance had not readily shared data and asserted that all of its relevant coronavirus data from NIH-supported research at the WIV has now been made public. U.S. officials and at least one of Daszak's former colleagues were stunned. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico.